tonight, the two gentlemen that are sitting up here, and you know, we all know Joe McCoy, and we also know Charlie Parmalee here, and needless to say, I suppose that each and every one of us here have really grown to like these guys. I asked him earlier, how would you like me to introduce you? And he says, I'd like you to just simply tell them they were just two old drunks from Arkansas. And you know, I don't think there's a better way, because in recovery here, we just for this weekend. So without taking any more to your time, here's present Joe and Charlie to you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's truly by God's grace and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I found in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sober today, and for that I'm very, very thankful. And I've been sober ever since I could remember. Think about that a little bit. And I want to tell you a little story here before we get underway. I was standing out there talking to the boys a while ago, and so I've got to run to the restroom. So I ran back there to the restroom right quick and standing there, and this lady tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, are you Joe or Joe and Charlie? And I said, yes, ma'am. And she said, do you ever get nervous at these things? And I said, oh, no, not really. She said, oh, really? I said, what are you doing in the ladies' restroom? I always like to start this thing with the reading of the preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. You know, we had a meeting last night and we talked about spirituality quite a bit, and I just can't think of a better setting to be in tonight for spirituality in this weekend. It's been absolutely wonderful so far, and I can't wait to look forward to what's going to happen the rest of the weekend. And I'm really, really glad you guys are here. There's a lot of old friends that we've met here. We love you dearly. Good to see you again. There's a lot of new friends we haven't met yet, but we'll get a chance to meet each other over the weekend. We'll be real close before the weekend's over with, and I'm looking forward to that. Charlie?
Hi, everybody. My name is Charlie Parmalee. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hi, Charlie.
Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and with the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found necessary to take a drink for 11,307 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. Hey, you guys look great. You really look great. Joe leaned over here a while ago, and he said, Charlie, this is the best-looking bunch of sick people we've seen in a long time. Yeah. I'm like Joe. This place up here is so special to me, and it's such a special occasion to be up here. But I'm always a little bit nervous when I'm here and start a big book study. But we'll get that all settled down after a while, I'm sure. We want to thank Bonnie and Ozzy and all the other people that's been working here at the Wilson House, setting this thing up, getting it ready to go. We know there's a tremendous amount of work involved in this and a lot of time put into it. We certainly thank them for doing so. We thank you all for being here this weekend. Wouldn't be much of a meeting if it were just Joe and I, so thank you for being here, too. Makes us feel better. We always like to say as we start one of these things, we do not consider ourselves to be the gurus of the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't consider ourselves to be the experts on anything at all. We're just two old drunks, met together several years ago, studied the Big Book together for quite some time. Hopefully, we've learned a few things about it. And those few things we've learned about it, we just love to be able to share them with other people. We do not attempt to speak for AA as a whole, and you are most certainly free to agree or disagree with anything that we say throughout the entire weekend as you see fit to do so. In fact, if you hear us saying things that can't be reconciled with what's in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, we suggest you just don't pay any attention to those things at all. And we'll try to keep most of our conversation centered on the big book itself. We believe our book when it says we are meant to be joyous, happy, and free. Joe and I love to laugh. We love to cut up. We love to have fun. We love to tell jokes. We love to hear other people laugh also. And from time to time throughout the weekend, we may stop whatever we're doing, tell a little joke just to get some humor started. And if we tell a joke and it isn't funny, we'll go ahead and laugh anyhow.
Please.
It'll make you feel better and make the one next to you feel better, and certainly will make us feel better too. We're fully aware of the fact that the mind will absorb only about what the rear end will stand. And some of these sessions do become quite long. And any time during one of these sessions, if you feel the need to get up and move around, please feel free to do so. That's not going to bother us at all. If you feel the need to go get a cup of coffee, it's my understanding it will be there all the time. Please feel free to do that. That's not going to bother us at all. If you feel the need to go outside and smoke a cigarette, please feel free to do that. It's not going to bother us at all. Or if you feel the need to go get rid of a cup of coffee, please feel free to do that too. There's no sense sitting here and suffering in silence. And I think if we can all approach this weekend with those ideas in mind, that maybe not only can we learn something about our book and our program, but we can have a good time while we're doing it. I don't know about you guys, but we're going to have fun, we're going to enjoy it, and I hope you do too. I always start off with a little story about we alcoholics. And this particular story involved a brain surgeon. And the brain surgeon had developed a way to transplant the human brain in its entirety. Been doing that with the other organs of the body for a long time. He found out how to do it with the brain. The older fellow went to see him and he said, "Doctor, I'm having a problem with my brain. I can't think anymore and I just can't figure things out, and I can't remember anything. Do you think maybe you could help me?" The doctor said, "Well, let's give you a good physical exam first and see what kind of shape your body's in." So he gave him a good physical exam, and he said, "Oh, yeah, your body's in great shape." He said, "I believe we could transplant a brain in your head, and everything would be all right." The old man said, "Well, great. What do you have to offer?" The doctor said, "Well, let's go up in the display room and I'll show you what we've got in stock at the present time." Went up in a display room and he said, "Now, in this case over here, I have the brains of an attorney." Said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be fine. It will cost you $20,000. The old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh, yeah. In this case over here, I have the brains of a doctor." Said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would work out fine. It'll cost you $50,000. The old man said, "Well, do you have anything else?" And he said, "Oh, yeah. In this case over here, I have the brains of an alcoholic." Said, "I could transplant this in your head. Everything would be fine. It'll cost you $100,000. The old man said, "Well, I don't understand this deal. $20,000 for the attorney brain, $50,000 for the doctor's brain, $100,000 for an alcoholic's brain." The doctor said, "Well, hell yes, man. It's brand new. It's never been used before." I think most of us will go to the grave with about 50,000 miles left on the original warranty. We never got around to using.
Okay. We're going to talk a bit about the book today, tonight, this weekend. Let's go to the forward to the second edition, Roman numeral page 15, which is XV. We're going to see a little bit of information here that some of us need to know.
We talk a little bit about some of the history behind the book. Being able to see some of that history, it's going to make it a lot easier for us to understand the book itself. And we find one of the best places for it is in the foreword to the second edition. And let's go there to that particular page, and we'll go to the last paragraph on the bottom of that page.
One of the things I've learned in studying Bill Wilson's writing over the years is he always does a certain thing in all of his writings. Once we understand this, then we can see his writings and see this repeated over and over and over. He'll always tell us what the problem is. He'll give us a solution to that problem. Then he'll give us a practical program of action to implement the solution, which he just described. He does that over and over and over. So we're going to learn here in the history where Bill learned about the problem, the solution, and the practical program of action. The last paragraph, it says, the spark that was to flare in the first AA group was struck at Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician.
Of course, we know that New York stockbroker to be this fellow named Bill Wilson. I think we're treating Bill pretty good when we call him a New York stockbroker. He really wasn't. He was a New York City stock speculator. He made his living out of selling fast, talking to slow-thinking people. We don't want to take anything away from Bill. He was a great man, but I think we all need to understand he's a real alcoholic, just like all the rest of us. Understanding that is going to make it easier to understand the book, because, of course, Bill is the primary author of the book. The Akron physician is this fellow named Dr. Bob Smith.
Now, 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend who'd been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day.
A little bit later on, we get into Bill's story. We're going to see where Bill had in the town's hospital in the fall of 1934 what he always referred to as a vital spiritual experience, which resulted in his recovery from alcoholism. But several things had to take place in Bill's life prior to having that vital spiritual experience, and one of them was this meeting with an alcoholic friend who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. And we all know the alcoholic friend is a fellow named Ebbie Thatcher. And Ebbie Thatcher came to visit Bill in Bill's kitchen in the fall of 1934. And he sat down with Bill, and he gave Bill what turned out to be two vital pieces of information. He said, Bill, people like you and I, who have become absolutely powerless over alcohol, in order to recover from that condition, we're going to have the aid of a power greater than human power. He said, we've tried all the human powers, the doctors, the hospitals, the psychiatrists, the psychologists, the ministers, and everything else. And he said, none of it has worked for us. And we're going to have the aid of a power greater than the human power if we are to recover from alcoholism. And he said, I've been attending meetings with a group of people called the Oxford Groupers. And they promised me that if I could have a vital spiritual experience, that during that vital spiritual experience, I would find the aid of a power greater than human power, and I would be able to recover from alcoholism. And he said, look at me, Bill. It's been 2 months since I've had a drink. And this made a great impression on Bill. He knew about Ebbie Thatcher. He knew about how Ebbie drank. He always said, if I ever get as bad as Ebbie, I'm going to quit drinking. And here's Ebbie sitting in Bill's kitchen, been sober now for 2 months, and Bill is about two-thirds drunk. So what he really gave to him there was the solution to alcoholism, the vital spiritual experience during which we find that power greater than human power. He also said they outlined a practical program of action, and they guaranteed me if I would follow that program of action, I would have that spiritual experience and I would be able to recover. And he gave him then the program of action necessary to be able to find the solution or to find the power greater than human power. So two of the things that it was necessary for Bill to know came to him from the Oxford groups through Ebbie, the solution being the vital spiritual experience, and the program of action necessary to have that spiritual experience. But also there was other information that Bill had to know too.
He'd also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who is now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. But from this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism.
And again, we're going to see when we get into Bill's story. But as far back as the summer of 1933, Bill was placed in the town's hospital in New York City for withdrawal from alcohol by Dr. Silkworth. After Dr. Silkworth got him withdrawn, got him to where he could kind of think and listen and hear, Dr. Silkworth sat down with Bill and gave him what turned out to be some extremely important information. He said, Bill, I do not believe that alcoholism is a matter of willpower. I do not believe it's a matter of moral character. And he said, I don't think sin's got anything to do with it at all. He said, I believe people like you are suffering from an illness, And he said, it's a very peculiar illness. It seems to be a twofold illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind. And he said, I think people like you, whenever you put any alcohol, whatever, into your system, something happens to you that doesn't happen to normal people. He said, I believe when you put alcohol into your system, it produces an actual physical craving that makes it virtually impossible for you to stop drinking after you have once started. And he said, because of that physical craving of the body, you'll never be able to safely drink alcohol again as long as you live. But he said, that's only half of your problem. He said, I also believe people like you have developed what we call an obsession of the mind. And he said, an obsession of the mind is an idea that overcomes all ideas to the contrary. And he said, it really doesn't make any difference how badly you want to quit drinking. It doesn't make any difference how hard you apply your willpower. He said, your obsession of the mind, sooner or later, is going to tell you that it's okay to drink. And believing that this time it's going to be different, this time we can have a couple of drinks and get by with it, believing something that isn't true, you'll take a drink based upon that obsession of the mind, thinking it's okay. Then the physical craving will take over, and then you'll end up drunk all over again. He said, not only can you not safely drink because of your body, but you can't stay sober because of your mind. And he said, if you can't drink without getting drunk, and if you can't live without drinking, then you've become absolutely powerless over alcohol. Now, Bill knew that in the summer of 1933. For the first time, he understood his problem. Because you see, up until then, he had thought it was willpower. He had thought it was moral character. He had thought it was sin. Why would he not? That's what everybody had told him up until that time. But when Dr. Silkworth sat down with him and explained to him his ideas about alcoholism, for the first time, Bill understood what the problem really was. And like so many of us, he said, now that I know what the problem is, now that I know what's wrong with me, I'll be able to live without drinking. And he left the town's hospital. Shortly thereafter, his mind told him it was okay to take a drink. He took a drink. He triggered the craving. He couldn't stop. He drank for another year. Back in the town's hospital under Dr. Silkworth again in the summer of 1934. So knowing the problem was not the answer to it. He figured now that he knew the problem, he wouldn't have to drink anymore, but sure enough he did. And in 1934, Dr. Silkworth pronounced him incurable and told Bill's wife, Lois, unless this guy is locked up somewhere, unless you hire a bodyguard for him, he's either going to die during DTEs or he'll become a wet brain within a very short period of time. And Bill heard that statement, and he said that this time fear sobered him up for a bit. But on Armistice Day 1934, his mind told him it was okay to take a drink. He took a drink, triggered the craving, couldn't stop drinking. So knowing the problem and fear was not enough to solve it either. It is only when Ebby came to see him and brought him the solution, the vital spiritual experience, brought him the program of action to have that spiritual experience, that Bill was able to recover from alcoholism. So basically, he had to know three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And what is the program of action necessary to find that solution? And based upon that information, he then recovered from alcoholism.
Abby presented Bill with a solution, and Abby began to take Bill to these Oxford group meetings. And her book so says that though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of the need of moral inventory, confession of personality defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God, which were some of the tenets of the Oxford group, which later on we know that Bill expanded those into the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And prior to his journey to Akron, the broker had worked hard with many alcoholics on the theory that only an alcoholic could help an alcoholic. But he succeeded only in keeping sober himself. Bill went about, after he applied these tenets to his life, and he began to stay sober for about 6 months there. And during that 6 months, he really liked the idea of helpfulness to others. So he started to try to help other people to receive this solution that he'd had. So he began to send them up out of the gutters, drag them off the streets, going into the bar and take them off the bar stool and take them. A lot of them didn't want to go, but he was taking them anyhow because he was trying to stay sober and trying to help them stay sober. And after about 6 months of this, well, he told Lois, Lois, I just don't understand. These people don't seem to want what I have. And she said, well, why don't you go talk to Dr. Silkworth and see what he says? So he went to see Dr. Silkworth and said, Dr. Silkworth, I've been working hard with alcoholics for 6 months and no one wants to get sober seemingly. And Dr. Silkworth said, yes, I've heard of some of that shenanigans you're pulling out there on the streets and the things you're trying to do, trying to shove and cram this spiritual thing down the throats of these alcoholics, and they just won't accept it. He said, why don't you do for them what I did for you? Why don't you talk to them about the physical allergy and the obsession of the mind? Tell them about the illness of alcoholism and how it worked within you and sharing your story. And then if they will accept that, then maybe you can talk to them about spiritual matters.
He said, Bill, every alcoholic I know has two questions. Number one, why can't I drink like I used to without getting drunk all the time? Number two, why can't I quit drinking now that I want to quit? He said, if you will explain to them the exact nature of the illness, you will get their attention. And he said, then after you get their attention, you can talk to them about spirituality. But he said, the first thing you got to do is get their attention. Tell them what's wrong with them. Now, we don't think it's by accident that the very next person Bill visited with and tried to help was Dr. Bob in Akron, Ohio. He said the broker had gone to Akron on a business venture which had collapsed, leaving him greatly in fear that he might start drinking again. He suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry his message to another alcoholic, and that alcoholic turned out to be the Akron physician. And we all know the story of Bill being there on this business deal in Akron. He and some other people had put a thing together in a proxy fight. They were going to take over one of the companies in Akron. Bill was going to get to be the president of the company. And the whole thing fell through on him. Standing in the lobby of the Mayflower Hotel, counting the money in his pocket and realized he didn't even have enough money to pay his hotel bill. Low, sad, depressed, and etc. And he happened to look through the door off the lobby into the bar. Now, I would imagine probably the lights were low in the bar and music was probably playing and the smoke was thick and the laughter was great. And Bill said, I believe I'll go in there and I'll be with people of my kind and I'll feel better and I'll go in and have a soda. But as he started to go through the door, for the first time, his mind said, Bill, you can't do that. If you go in there, you're going to drink, and if you drink, you're going to be in all kinds of trouble. So in desperation, Bill made a few phone calls and came in contact through Henrietta Sibling with this fellow named Dr. Bob Smith. And I think we all need to remember that Bill called upon Dr. Bob not to sober up Dr. Bob, but to keep Bill Wilson from getting drunk. And of course, Henrietta set the meeting up for him at her home, there on the Sibling estate. She ended up calling Ann and said, Ann, we've got a fellow here from New York City that seems to think he might have the answer to alcoholism, and I'd like to set up a meeting between him and Dr. Bob. Can you bring Dr. Bob over? And Ann said, no, I'm sorry, I can't. Said, you know, this is Mother's Day, and tomorrow is Mother's Day, and he's brought home a potted plant for me, and he's potted under the kitchen table at the present time, and he can't come. So Henrietta said, we'll try to get him straightened out and try to get him over here tomorrow. And she set up a time for him to meet the next day.
You know, I think sometimes how Henrietta Sibling was quick to go along with this setup and this meeting between Bill and Dr. Bob. Well, see, Dr. Bob is a member of the Oxford Group. And sometime before this, the Oxford Group decided to pray that Dr. Bob would find a solution to his problem. And here's this fellow who comes bringing a solution. So I'm sure that the next morning, Ann said, we're going to go over to Henrietta Sibring's estate, and we're going to visit with this fellow from New York who seems to have a solution for alcoholism. And Dr. Bob said, well, I'm not going. And she said, oh, yes, you are. And he said, oh, no, I'm not. She said, oh, yes, you know how this goes.
Hungover,
bad. He was in bad shape. He said, okay, all right, I'll go over there for 15 minutes, no more. That's it. So they went over there, and he was planning on staying for 15 minutes. And Bill sat down with him and began to talk about his story and the illness of alcoholism, talking about the physical allergy and the obsession of the mind. And Bill and Dr. Bob began to identify with this. And Dr. Bob, later, he was to stay there for more than 5 hours talking to Bill. Later on in some of his writings, he said that Bill Wilson was the first person that he'd ever talked to that really knew what he was talking about. And he really identified with Bill.
And our book says, this physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but had failed. But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. You know, I don't think this is coincidence at all. Remember, Bill had just talked to Dr. Silkworth, and Silky had said, quit cramming that spirituality down their throat. Tell them exactly what's wrong with them. So when Bill met with Dr. Bob, he really couldn't even talk to Dr. Bob about spirituality anyhow, because he was amazed to find out Dr. Bob was already in the Oxford groups, had been in the Oxford groups much longer than Bill, knew more about spirituality than Bill knew. So that left Bill really with nothing new to tell him anyhow, except what is the problem. And this time Bill did something he had never done before in trying to work with another alcoholic. He sat down with Dr. Bob, and he didn't talk to Dr. Bob about Dr. Bob's drinking. Thank God he didn't. Everybody else had already done that. Bill said, let me tell you about my drinking. And he began to tell his story. And he told about the many, many, many times stopped off in the speakeasy, just going to have one or two drinks, then go home and have dinner with Lois. And he said, I'd have those two drinks and something would take over, and I would be unable to stop drinking, and I would end up drunk and sick and may not get home till midnight that night or the next night or the next week. Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been happening to me. And Bill said, well, there's a doctor in New York City called Dr. Silkworth. And he explained to me that this is a physical craving that is produced in the body by the alcohol itself. And he said, because of that physical craving, every time we try to drink, we end up drunk and sick all the time. He continued with his story, and he told about the many, many times that he had sworn off drinking. He said, man, I got a tremendous amount of willpower. I've always been able to do anything that I wanted to do based on willpower. And he said, I'll swear off drinking in the morning, and by noon I'm sitting in a bar or speakeasy half drunk, wondering how in the hell did I get here this time? Dr. Bob said, my God, man, that's what's been happening to me. And Bill said, well, this same doctor explained to me that this is an obsession of the mind, and because of the obsession of the mind, willpower does not work for people like us. Through the sharing of his own story with Dr. Bob, Dr. Bob was able to see his problem. For the first time, he understood that it's not willpower, that it's not moral character, that it's not sin, that it's an actual illness, an illness of the body as well as an illness of the mind. Then Dr. Bob could apply the Oxford Group program to a depth that he never had before, and lo and behold, he recovered from alcoholism too. So he had to know the three things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And what is the program of action?
He said he sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death in 1950. Now this seemed to prove that one alcoholic could affect another as no non-alcoholic could. As no non-alcoholic could.
By Bill sharing his story with Dr. Bob.
It also indicated that strenuous work, one alcoholic with another, was vital to permanent recovery.
Bill was just about to get drunk before he talked to Dr. Bob. So through the sharing of his story with Dr. Bob, Bill stayed sober.
Said, and one night after Dr. Bob got sober, they were talking one night, and Dr. Bob said, Bill, if we're going to do this thing, we better get busy. He said, what do you mean get busy? He said, we're going to have to get busy helping some drunks. He said, Bill said, I don't know any drunks, do you? And he said, well, no, not really. But I know this head nurse down at the hospital. Surely she knows a drunk down there. I'll call her up. And so he called up the head nurse down there and said, do you have any drunks in the hospital at this moment? She said, well, yes, I do. He said, well, I've got this fellow from New York who seems to have a solution for alcoholism. why don't you put this fellow in a private room and we'll be down? And she said, by the way, Dr. Bob, have you tried this solution on yourself? She knew he was quite good to drink. It says, hence the two men set to work almost frantically upon alcoholics arriving in the ward of the Akron City Hospital. And all, some of you know what a ward is, but I did too. Some of you don't. But a ward is at the end of the hall where you can't afford a private room or a semi-private room, mostly a charity case. And if you need a hospitalization, they'll put you at the end of the hall, put some screens around you with some other people, and give you some help. But if you look like you're going to die, they'll take you off the ward and put you in a private room. So they took this fella off the ward and put him in a private room. He's the very first case, a desperate one, recovered immediately and became AA number 3, which we know that to be the lawyer, Bill Dotson.
Now, Bill Dotson is, of course, in the picture, and I think it's up here behind us called the man on the bed. And this is Bill, and Bob's sitting there talking to Bill Dotson. And through the sharing of their stories with Bill Dotson, first thing that happened is Bill Dotson was able to see what his problem was. Because you see, like everybody else, he thought it was willpower, moral character, and sin. But as they talked about their own physical craving that developed after they took a drink, as they talked about their own obsession of the mind, Bill Dotson identified with them immediately. And for the first time, he understood his problem. They also gave him the solution. The need for the vital spiritual experience, finding of the power greater than human power. They also gave him the program of action necessary to find that. 2 days later, he says to his wife, "Get my clothes out of the closet, I'm going home." He got up, dressed, went home, applied the little program of action, had a vital spiritual experience, and lo and behold, he recovered from alcoholism too. We've now got 3 of them. This is the summer now of 1935 in New York City, or in Akron, Ohio. And all 3 of them know 3 things. What is the problem? What is the solution? And what's the program of action necessary to find it? All 3 had applied the program of action, recovered from alcoholism.
This work continued at Akron, continued through the summer of 1935. There were many failures, but there was an occasional heartening success.
Now, we go back and look at that time period, and we got to remember now that these guys, they really didn't know what they were doing. Everything they tried was something new. And they would try something, and if it worked, they would retain it. If it didn't work, they would throw it out and try something else. And they tried many, many things during that summer to help alcoholics. Most of them they failed with. You know, one of Dr. Bob's favorite things was to fill them up with sauerkraut juice mixed with honey. The sauerkraut juice had some vitamins in it that the body needed, and of course the honey would make it possible for them to be able to drink the stuff. They tried that amongst many, many different things. And every once in a while, one of these guys would fall over dead. I can almost see Bill turn to Bob and say, "Oh, crap, let's don't do that again." So as we look at that period of time, we always give credit to Bill, Bob, the first 100, which rightfully we should. But I think sometimes we need to stop and maybe give credit to those they failed with that summer. They probably learned more from the failures than they did from the successes. So a lot of our stuff that we know today came from those that they failed with. He said when the broker returned to New York in the fall of 1935, the first AA group had actually been formed, though no one realized it at the time. At the end of that summer of 1935, Bill said, "I got to go back to New York City. Got to start making a little money. My wife's back there. I need to get back in business." And Bill left there, and what he left behind him was a few individuals who were members of the Oxford group. Now, from the very beginning, though, there was some problems between the regular Oxford groupers and the alcoholics. The Oxford groupers were not into the business of sobering up drunks. Their main thing was to help anybody that had problems of the more elite members of society. They liked to work with people like the Firestones and etc. And maybe they could straighten up the mayor of the town maybe the governor of the state, maybe the president of the country. Maybe eventually they could straighten out the whole world through their program. That's what they were really into.
You've heard of that trickle-down theory with that.
And the drunks, they were having a problem with the drunks. The drunks would come to the meetings, smoke cigarettes, drop ashes on the floor, spill coffee, and tell dirty jokes. Oxford groupers wasn't too crazy about that. The Oxford groupers had a thing they called the four absolutes, where you would practice absolute love, absolute purity, absolute honesty, and absolute unselfishness. The drunks were having a hell of a time being absolute anything except drunks. So to separate themselves from the normal Oxford groupers, they began to call themselves the drunk squad of the Oxford group. That's what Bill left behind him. No AA, the drunk squad of the Oxford group.
By late 1937, the number of members having substantial sobriety time behind them was sufficient to convince the membership that a new light had entered the dark world of the alcoholic. A second small group had promptly taken shape in New York, and besides, there were scattered alcoholics who picked up the basic ideas in Akron or New York and were trying to form AA groups. Remember, no AA groups, just the drunk squad of the Oxford group.
When Bill went back to New York City, he started doing there the same thing that he had learned to do on his visit with Dr. Bob. He found him a drunk, and he talked to him about the illness, the exact nature of the illness. And lo and behold, the guy got interested. Then he also became a member of the Oxford group, and he recovered from alcoholism. A few people began to get sober up in Cleveland. So by late 1937, Bill was back again in Akron on a business trip, stopped in to see Dr. Bob, and they counted heads of those that they knew were staying sober in these three little locations. And to their amazement, they found approximately 40 people staying sober. And I think for the first time, they begin to realize, maybe we really do have the answer to this thing called alcoholism. And if we've got the answer to it, then the question now becomes, what are we going to do with it? Now, they could have just as well franchised it and sold it or tried to. They could have just as well said, well, we've got enough already. We'll just keep it for ourselves. But one of the things coming out of the Oxford group was, if you're going to keep this thing, you have to give it away. So the real question was not whether we keep it or not, not whether we sell it or not. The real question was, how can we give it to the greatest number of alcoholics, period? And maybe this is the beginning of the group conscience in AA. Bill and Bob made the decision that they didn't want to make that decision. They called a meeting of the Oxford group there in Akron. There was approximately 18 people at the meeting. Most of them were non-alcoholics. And the whole topic of that particular meeting was, how can we give this information to the greatest number of alcoholics, period?
He said it was now time that the struggling groups thought to place their message and unique experience before the world. This determination bore fruit in the spring of 1939 by the publication of this volume.
Okay, three things they decided to do at that Oxford group meeting. First thing they decided to do, and probably I'm sure Dr. Bob influenced it, was to build a chain of hospitals stretching all the way across the United States where any alcoholic that needed detox would be able to get in there and be detoxed through medical help. You know, in those days, you could hardly get a drunk in a hospital. Doctor had to lie to get them in there. In fact, that was true when I came in back in the 1960s. You could hardly get a drunk in a hospital. And I'm sure Dr. Bob was probably going to be the head doctor, too. They also felt that this information was already becoming garbled, and not everybody would be capable of carrying it one drunk to another. So they needed to hire and train a special group of people and let them fan out across the United States carrying this message of recovery to other alcoholics. Probably Bill was going to be the head missionary too, I imagine. But then they said, you know, this information that we've got, carrying it one to another is already becoming garbled. It's already being changed. We need to take this information, put it down in the written form, so that alcoholics of the future will know it as we know it today. And they said, besides that, you know, the Oxford Group people, they're writing a lot of spiritual books, and people are buying them good. This is back in the 1930s, before television. People read a lot in those days. There really was a time before television. Believe me, there was. And they said, if we could take this information and put it in a book form, telling others what the problem is as we know it, what the solution is, what the program of action is, this would be the first book written on alcoholism that people could really use it to recover from that condition. And probably it would become one of the world's bestsellers. And we could take the proceeds off of the book and build the hospitals and hire and train the missionaries. So they made a decision to write the book. Now, thank God, in the beginning, the book didn't sell very good. They didn't get any money to build hospitals and hire and train missionaries. But they did write the book.
Can you see the thinking of an alcoholic's mind, trying to build hospitals and missionaries and all the profits off of the book? Great ideas, you know. Well, they made a decision. Isn't it wonderful when you make a decision? Said the membership had then reached about 100 men and women after they wrote the book.
Okay, the first Alcoholics Anonymous that the world ever saw was a book titled Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, they had thought about many different names for this book. Now, one time they thought about naming it The Way Out. That would have been a good title for it. Another one was called Comes the Dawn. That would have been a good title for it. Another one they thought of was The 100 Men. That would have been a great title for
it. Sounds like a good title for a book, doesn't it? 100 Men.
But a woman came along and joined the group and screwed that up. So.
Couldn't call it 100 Men and a Woman.
Bill at one time let his ego get involved. He said, well, let's just call it the Bill W. Movement. And, of course, that didn't last but about 5 seconds. And decided on something else. And the ultimate decision was made to call it Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this one I've got in my hand, Big John. Big John, you here?
No. He's not here.
Oh, he's there. Yeah. This belongs to Big John. And Big John tells me this is Hank Parkhurst, the fourth AA member's original book. This is a first printing, first edition. I always laugh when I look at it. Can you just see some alcoholic trying to remain anonymous walking down the street with this under his arm? I think I see the alcoholic thinking, let's make it real bright colors. It'll catch the eye, and then we'll be able to sell the thing, you know. Also, if you open this book up, the printing on the page is the same identical size as it is today. But you notice how wide the margins are at the bottom and the top and the side of the pages. The wider the margins, the bigger the book. The bigger the book, the more eyes it's going to catch. They printed it on the cheapest old paper they could possibly find. Cheap paper is thick paper. And when you got thick paper, then you got a real thick book. That's why they call it the big book.
It's a big book.
That doesn't say a bit more than the book that you have today, but you notice how big it is. And one other thing, and then we'll leave it. John don't like for me to do this, but I'm going to do it anyhow. You notice it's red with gold colors on it. Also, I think part of the alcoholic thinking, let's make it real bright. Make it pretty, make it look good, and it'll sell good. Well, thank God, in the beginning, it didn't sell hardly at all. That's why we don't have the hospitals and why we don't have the missionaries.
Yeah. And this book was called Alcoholics Anonymous. So the very first Alcoholics Anonymous that the world has ever seen was a book called Alcoholics Anonymous, written by the drunk squad of the Oxford Group. Then our book says
thank
this.
You, John.
This fledgling society, this drunk squad of the Oxford Group, which had been nameless, now began to be called Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. So we have two Alcoholics Anonymous, don't we? We have a book entitled Alcoholics Anonymous, the first Alcoholics Anonymous the world's ever seen, and this drunk squad of the Oxford Group, they begin to call themselves Alcoholics Anonymous from the title of its own book. to AA as we have today.
In 1939, the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous was the same as the program in the fellowship. The little fellowship, the 100 men and women, took the program they practiced, put it in written form, put it in a book, and called it Alcoholics Anonymous. The program in the fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous. The program in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, were exactly the same. The first one in the state of Texas. The first one here and the first one there and the first one over there. The growth of the fellowship began to come from the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, as the fellowship began to grow and began to get bigger and bigger and bigger, they noticed something that the original fellowship didn't have. They began to notice the great strength and the great power that comes from large numbers of men and women gathering together who have suffered from and recovered from the same condition. You know, the original membership didn't have the great power of the fellowship. They only had 100 people spread around in three or four different groups. They couldn't go to 90 meetings in 90 days. They didn't have that. They depended upon the program and the book. But as the fellowship began to grow and get bigger and bigger and bigger, people began to question the need for the severity of the program in the book. And they began to say things like, do you think we really need to turn all of our will and all of our life over to the care of God as we understand Him? Couldn't we just give Him the alcohol and we'll take care of the rest? They begin to question the need for step five. You know, why in the world do we need to talk about this stuff to another human being? We already know it. God already knows it. Why do we need to share it with another human being? They said, do you mean we got to get rid of all of our character defects? How in the hell are we going to make a living if we do that? Do you mean we have to make amends to all those people we've harmed? And I begin to hear such statements as, well, maybe we don't have to do everything the book says. Maybe we can treat it like a cafeteria. Maybe we could take some and leave some and everything would be okay. And I begin to hear such statements as, well, everybody has a right to develop their own program in their own way. And they begin to talk about the fact you can't tell another alcoholic what to do. And they begin to talk about old-timers can't teach newcomers that everybody will have to find their program in their own way. And they begin to water down the program. And long about the 60s, early 70s, we had the great advent of the treatment centers. Now, please don't get us wrong. We've got nothing against treatment centers. They serve a very good purpose. But in the majority of the treatment centers, in order to justify their being, they're going to have to be doing something other than the program of Alcoholics Anonymous out of the big book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they get into many things in treatment centers which really has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Then the person from the treatment center comes into AA. And they want to talk about what they learned in a treatment center. And I don't blame them. I would too. But as they brought in this new type of wording out of the treatment centers, you begin to hear many things in AA which had never been there before. You begin to hear about dual addiction. You begin to hear about poly-addicted. You begin to hear about chemically dependent. You begin to hear about dysfunctional families. You begin to hear about meaningful relationships. You begin to hear about dysfunctional sex. And some of the AA meetings got so bad, and some of them are that way today, that if you went to that meeting and they didn't read the preamble before the meeting, you wouldn't know what kind of meeting you're in. Because they talk about everything except alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism. We call those group depression meetings. You go in there feeling pretty good. Hell, halfway through the meeting, you might as well just blow your brains out. There's no reason to be alive at all. So thank God the book Alcoholics Anonymous, though, The program in it has never changed. So what we're going to be talking about all weekend is not the program in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to be talking about the program in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And then we'll challenge you after you leave here and go back to your home group, wherever it might be, to see how closely the program in your home group resembles the program in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And then maybe over a period of time, we can make some changes and get us back into the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, many of the old timers in AA blame this problem on the newcomer. They say, well, the newcomer comes in here and they won't talk about everything except Alcoholics Anonymous, and we can't identify with them, and we're just going to stay home. But when the old timer does that, that means we've abdicated our responsibility for AA. We've turned it over to the sickest of the sickest, who are the newcomers. And then we stand back and say, look at what they're doing to our AA. I don't think it's the newcomer's fault. I think it's our fault for letting those things happen to us in the first place. There's not enough of us that are willing to stand up and say, look, what you learned out there in that treatment center or wherever you learned, it might be good stuff, but that's not AA information. Here's AA information. And we talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. We talk about solutions to problems rather than talk about problems. Now, that's what they learn in treatment centers, in group therapy, to sit around and talk about problems. In AA, we talk about the solution to those problems. There's a little pamphlet out. Bill himself wrote it, called Problems Other Than Alcohol. And in this pamphlet, he makes a statement that the sole purpose, not a purpose, not one, but the sole purpose of an AA group is sobriety through the practice and the teaching of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's up to we old timers to see that's what AA is. And maybe, maybe, maybe we can get our fellowship back in its program, Joe.
Remember one time I called...
No more preaching. I won't preach anymore all weekend, I promise.
Hope you don't believe that. I called my sponsor one time, Franklin. I said, Franklin, my program's not working very good. And he said, well, tell me about your program. And I said, well, I'm mad at my wife, and I'm mad at the people I work with, and I'm pretty mad at some of the people in the group. My program's not working good. And he said, well, Joe, your program's working just the way it was designed to work. He said, have you ever tried working the program? Now, there's a lot of difference between my program and the program, I can tell you that. So let's look and see what kind of success they were having when the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous from the book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's go to Roman numeral page 20, please. He said, while the internal difficulties of our adolescent period were being ironed out, public acceptance of AA grew by leaps and bounds.
Right up at the top of the page. Yeah.
Yeah, Roman numeral page 20. For this, there were two principal reasons: the large number of recoveries and reunited homes. Somehow or another, we've gotten off that way about being reunited homes. Just my opinion. Now, these made their impressions everywhere. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sober at once and remained that way. 25% sobered after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. Other thousands came to a few AA meetings and first decided they didn't want the program. But great numbers of these, about 2 out of 3, began to return as time passed. If my math is correct, that 75% of those people who came to AA and really tried got sober and ultimately stayed sober. 75%. Now, I don't know if you can talk about 75% in your area. We can't even fantasize about that. You know? And I know we can't talk about 50% or 25%. We may even be talking about 5% or less. And the reason I believe and we believe for that is that people in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous got away from the book called Alcoholics Anonymous, and the recovery rate began to go down. And we're saying here, I think, that if we can get back to the book Alcoholics Anonymous, back to the principles in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, through the practice and teaching of the 12 steps, the recovery rate can come back up.
I doubt if we get back to 75%, but I think we could do better than what we're doing today. There's thousands and thousands and thousands of alcoholics coming to AA today. You know nothing about the program. Nobody's telling them anything about the program. They're telling them, keep coming to meetings and you'll be okay. Just don't drink, do 90 meetings in 90 days and everything will be all right. And they're dying from alcoholism. That's not their fault. That's our fault. Now that we know a little something about the history, let's go back to the table of contents now for just a moment. And let's see if our book isn't laid out basically just exactly the same way that the first 100 had to know their information in order to recover from alcoholism.
You know,
can you reach that or you want me to? Okay.
Hope you can see this up here.
You got a little booklet that you were given when you checked in. And from time to time, we'll have a picture up here on the wall behind us. If you can't see it too clearly, you'll have it in your booklet also, so you'll be able to take a look at it.
You know, I'm in the printing business and have been all my life, and I have published books like this. I know a little bit about the nomenclature of a book and how they're supposed to be laid out. But when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked at this book, and my thought was this. What a bunch of old drunks going to know about laying out a book? They don't know nothing about it. And I did like everybody else did. I skipped around in it, read here, read some there and over there. Finally dawned on us one day, and looking at this book, after we'd been restored to a little bit of sanity, we began to see that this book was laid out in a certain sequence to bring about certain ideas. This book has certain goals in it. It has basically three goals in it. And the first goal is to tell us what the problem is. And they're going to use the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, and some of it in Chapter 3, but mostly it's in the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, going to show us what the problem is. The second goal is they're going to show us the solution to this problem that they just described. And so they're going to use Chapter 2, there is a solution. And then Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, in case we don't like the solution that was presented to us, as Bill didn't like the position. He didn't like it either, remember? So he's going to tell us a little bit more about alcoholism. And he knew that we were going to have trouble as he did. Remember, his mind snapped shut against such theories about God. So he wrote us a little chapter called We Agnostics to help us to get over those ideas that some of us brought in here. And the word agnostic is a very powerful word. Gnostic means knowledge. You put the ag before any word, it means without. Those are us who are without knowledge. And I think that's what I was one who was without knowledge. So they helped me then that chapter tremendously. The third goal was the action necessary for recovery. And he begins with Chapter 5, how it works. He's going to tell us how it works. Then he's going to write a little chapter called Into Action. See, this is not an into thinking, but into action. And action is a magic word in Alcoholics Anonymous always. And then after we have recovered from alcoholism and had this spiritual experience, he's going to tell us in Chapter 7 how to work with other people, how to bring them into the fellowship just the way we were.
You know, as we go through these chapters, we'll notice we're also going to be talking about the steps. Step 1 said we're powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. And as we read the doctor's opinion in Bill's story, some of it in Chapter 2 and 3, most of it in doctor's opinion and Bill's story, we're going to be able to see the information that it was necessary for Bill to know that came from Dr. Silkworth in order for him to really understand what the problem is, the physical craving of the body, the obsession of the mind. And basically, we're dealing with Step 1. So we could just say Step 1 is we are powerless. Now, obviously, if the problem is powerless, then the answer is going to lie within power. And we're going to find that we can do nothing about the physical craving of the body. The only way we can recover is through the idea of doing something about the obsession of the mind. And through Chapters 2, 3, and 4, we're going to see all the information necessary in order for us to be able to believe that there is a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. So there we're going to be looking at Step 2. Well, obviously, if our problem is powerless, and if the answer lies within power, then the only other thing we need to know is how are you going to find that power? And we're going to find three chapters, 5, 6, and 7, devoted to telling us how to find that power. And within those three chapters, we're going to find the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I get amused at people today when they say, I'm going to a step study meeting. And they're always referring to 12 and 12. But if you're reading the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, you're in a step study meeting. It just depends on which part of the book you're reading as to which step you're going to be in. We have part of it, one goal is the problem. The next thing is the solution. The next thing is the program of action necessary to find that solution. The same three things that Bill had to know, the same three things that Dr. Bob had to know, the same three things they carried to Bill Dotson, and the same three things they put in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Because you see, the big book really makes a 12-step call. They knew that the first person out in California, hell, they couldn't go see them and talk to them and share their stories. The big book had to do that. So the big book does in writing exactly what they were doing on a personal basis, one-on-one. Amazing when we saw that. And when you really see this in the big book, then it becomes a very fascinating book to be able to see how one chapter ties directly to the next, and to the next. One paragraph leads you directly into the next thing. It really becomes then a fascinating book when you once begin to look at it that way. Okay, let's go over now for just a few moments to the preface, Roman numeral 11.
He said, because this book has become the basic text for our society and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume describing the AA recovery program has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and the third editions. The section called the Doctor's Opinion has been kept intact, just as it was originally written in 1939 by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, our society's great medical benefactor.
I think there's two ideas there we need to look at. Number one, we see the words basic text. I think we're alerted to the type book we have in front of us. There's all kind of books in the world today. You got novels written on fact and novels written on fiction. You have biographies, autobiographies, concordances. We could name many, many kind of books. But we all know what a textbook really is. And some of us, as we remember textbooks, we kind of have an aversion to them.
Every time I read about textbooks, all I can think about is cheat. I don't know why that is.
We remember how in school we had to spend hours and hours and hours studying textbooks and taking tests on them, and et cetera. But if we look at a textbook in its simplest form, all in the world it is a way or a means of transferring information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book. Basically, that's what a textbook is. And by the way, that's all teaching is, too. You know, one of the phrases I keep hearing going around AA is, you can't teach. Well, I don't know why you can't. Teaching is nothing more than transference of information from one mind to another, increasing the knowledge of the one that's being taught. Hell, we all teach every day, and we're all being taught every day. A textbook is nothing more than a tool to be used in the teaching process. A textbook is usually written in a certain way or a certain style or a certain fashion. A textbook will usually assume that the reader of the book will know very little about the subject matter. Normally starts at a very simple level. Then as the reader progresses through the book, their knowledge increases, the information presented becomes more difficult too. Let's take a textbook on mathematics. Let's say my friend Joe here knows nothing at all about mathematics. He can't add, he can't subtract, he can't do any of those things. Oh, he could probably count to 21 if he's standing there naked and got everything where it belongs. He might count to 21.
20,
but he knows nothing.
Yeah, 20 and a half, actually.
And I walk up to Joe and I hand him a textbook on mathematics and I say, I want you to go to chapter 5 and work the algebra problems. Well, being a good fellow, he'll go to chapter 5, but he can't even add and subtract. He just sees a bunch of scratches on paper. He has no idea what to do. But if I say Joel chapter 1 in this book on mathematics deals with the value of numbers, addition and subtraction, if you'll read it, study it, ask questions, let me help you, by the time you're through with chapter 1, you'll know how to add and subtract. And sure enough, he does that. And I say, now that you know how to add and subtract, you can go to chapter 2, and then you'll be able to learn how to multiply and divide. And he does that. And then we take him to chapter 3, and he learns how to do fractions and decimals, and we gradually prepare his mind for the algebra problems in chapter 5. I think the greatest mistake I see being made today in AA in regards to the big book is a newcomer walks in the door, somebody hands them the big book, and they say, go to chapter 5 and do what it says, and you'll be okay. And a newcomer goes to chapter 5, and immediately they run into a series of algebra problems. Step 1 said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, our lives had become unmanageable. The newcomer said, man, I'm not powerless over anything. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Step 2 said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. The newcomer said, man, don't tell me I'm crazy. Yeah, I do stupid things when I'm drunk, but when I'm sober, I'm much less. They have no idea what we mean by that statement. Well, if you're not powerless and you're not nuts, then you don't need to be thinking about making a decision and turn your will and your life over to the care of something you don't understand in the first place. We present them with an impossible situation. If we can do nothing else all weekend, I hope we're going to be able to see the value of the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters and how they dovetail together, one chapter leading to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next, to prepare our minds for chapter 5. Because you see, chapter 5 starts with step 3. And God, it's hard to start with 3 if you don't have 1 and 2 behind you. And the newcomer knows none of that. So it's a real textbook, written in standard textbook form. One chapter leading to the next, to the next, to the next, and to the next. The other thing that's so important is because it's helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Therefore, the first portion of this volume, describing the AA recovery program, has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second and third editions. In 1955, they said, look, these stories in the back of the book, which are there for the newcomer to find themselves to identify with, they no longer accurately reflect the membership of Alcoholics Anonymous. By 1955, bottom had come up. Age had come down. More and more women coming into AA. And they said, we need to change those stories in the back of the book so they will more accurately reflect the membership as of 1955. They made a decision to come out with a second edition. They dropped some of the stories in the back, added some new ones in, but they left the recovery section untouched. In 1976, they made the same decision. Dropped some of the stories in the back, added some new ones, came out with a third edition, but they left the recovery section untouched. Now next year at the General Service Conference, the delegates are to be presented with a fourth edition with the same instructions. Change stories in the back of the book, leave the recovery section untouched. And I think that's the greatest miracle in Alcoholics Anonymous today. God, you know how we love to change things. Anybody that's ever read this book has rewritten it 2 or 3 times in their mind. But collectively, we've never found it necessary to change the recovery section of the book. I wonder why. Anybody care to venture? It works, doesn't it? I wonder why it works as good today as it did in 1939. Very simple. 3 things. 1, alcoholics haven't changed. They're still getting drunk today. They get in knife fights, car wrecks, divorce courts, hospitals, jailhouses, penitentiaries, and cemeteries. Still doing the same fun things today they were doing in 1939. Alcohol hasn't changed. Oh, the names have changed, the bottles have changed, the colors have changed, but alcohol is still exactly the same thing. Human nature never changes. It's the same today as it was 2,000 years ago. And that's what our book deals with. It deals with alcoholics, alcohol, and human nature, and we've never found it necessary to change it because it still works just as good today as it did in 1939. And a lot of people in AA today are trying to change it. A lot of people are saying, oh, you don't understand. Times have changed. Places have changed. I say, yeah, that's true. But what you don't understand is drunks haven't changed. They're just today like they used to be, Joe.
Okay, let's go to the forward to the first edition, Roman numeral page 13. That's XIII. And it says we, and that's probably the biggest word in all of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, two different things, and later on, well, tomorrow morning we're going to separate the body from the mind and talk about them separately. But it's a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and it's to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. We see words in this book like precisely, specifically, exactly, with clear-cut directions throughout this book. So this book is not a book on just about how to recover from alcoholism. This book is going to tell us precisely, specifically, with exactly, with clear-cut directions on how to recover. And guess what? If I want to recover from alcoholism, I need to try to do precisely, specifically, and exactly follow those clear-cut directions as they did, or I may not recover from alcoholism.
I think in that part that Joe just read, there's again a couple of ideas we need to look at. The first one is, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women. Most books I read have been authored by one person. And when I read a book that's been authored by one person, I see something in there I don't agree with. With my keen intellectual alcoholic mind, I usually say, who in the hell are they to think they're smarter than I am? And I just ignore it. But if I do that with a big book, I've got to realize I'm not going to be arguing with one person. I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women. You know, the first 40 told Bill, they said, Bill, we want you to write the book. You've been sober longer than anybody else, and at that time a little over 3 years. He said, you know more about it than the rest of us. We want you to write it. But it's not to be your book. It's to be our book. And as you write those chapters, we want to see them. We will add to, we'll take out, we'll delete, we'll change around, we'll do whatever's necessary. When we're through with it, it'll be the collective knowledge, experience, and wisdom of all 40 of us. Okay, by 1939, when the book was published, that 40 had changed to 100. So I think I've got to realize today that if I'm going to argue with the book, I'm going to be arguing with 100 men and women, not just one. That makes it a little harder for me to argue with them. Also, it makes it harder for me to argue with them when I realize that they have recovered from the same thing that's killing me, a hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism, which brings up the word recovered. It's amazing how many arguments we hear about this. Can you really recover from alcoholism? Well, I hope we can. If we can't, we're in bad, bad shape. I'll never be cured of alcoholism. I will always have the physical allergy. I'll never be able to safely drink alcohol for the rest of my life. Now, before I came to AA, though, not only could I not safely drink alcohol, I couldn't keep from drinking alcohol. And I lived in a hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism, and almost destroyed me. After coming to AA and working this program, I still cannot successfully drink alcohol, but by golly, I can keep from drinking it. And I don't live in that hopeless condition of mind and body. I've recovered from that condition, although I will always be alcoholic. And you're going to see the word recovered throughout the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing I think is so important is to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. You'll notice precisely how we have recovered is in italics. I call it squiggly writing.
It's really italic.
And when you see squiggly writing in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous, it's usually something very important We need to go back and look at it, make sure we understand it, precisely how we have recovered. Now, Joe and I have been in AA long enough to know and fully understand. You can't make anybody in AA do anything they don't want to do. The only requirement for membership in AA is a desire to stop drinking. You can go to an AA meeting, you can stand up in the meeting and say, I don't like you suckers at all. Almost vomit when I read the 12 steps. Can barely drink your lousy old coffee. But I'm going to be a member of AA because I've got a desire to stop drinking, and nobody can do a thing about that. But that deals with membership and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our book has nothing to do with membership and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our book deals with one thing and one thing only, recovery from a hopeless condition of mind and body known as alcoholism. And the purpose of this book is to show other alcoholics precisely how the first 100 did it. It's kind of like making cake. Let's say we go to a potluck meeting somewhere in AA and there's a strawberry cake there. That happens to be my favorite. If you ever make me one, make it strawberry. I love it. And I bite into that cake, and it's just perfect. Oh, the texture's right. The taste is right. The moisture content's right. Just perfect. And I say, who made this cake? And you being a good cake, you'd probably say, well, I did. And I say, would you tell me how you did it? And you say, I'll be glad to. And you sit down and you write out for me a precise set of directions on how to make that cake. You tell me the ingredients to put in it, the quantity of the ingredients to put in it, the sequence in which to mix them together, the temperature at which to bake it, and how long to bake it. Now, if I take your directions in my kitchen, and if I follow them precisely as you've laid them out, when that thing comes out of the oven and cools off, and I bite into it, I think I could expect it to taste exactly like your cake tasted. But if I take your directions in my kitchen, and my keen intellectual alcoholic mind starts working, it might say, well, now I don't know about this 4 eggs. Maybe I ought to put 6 in it. Instead of 2 cups of sugar, I ought to put 3. Instead of baking it at 375, maybe I ought to bake it for 450. Instead of baking it for 18 minutes, maybe I ought to bake it for 28. When that thing comes out of the oven and cools off, and I bite into it, you betcha I'm going to be biting into a piece of cake. But I wonder how closely it would resemble your cake, which was my reason for making it in the first place. A precise, specific, clear-cut set of directions on how to recover from alcoholism. Now, normally at this point, we go into the doctor's opinion, but due to the changing of the time for the night, we're going to wait and go into the doctor's opinion tomorrow morning. That's all we've got for tonight. Joe, you got anything else?
I got some more in the morning, but not tonight. Morning, everyone. My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic. And it's truly by God's grace and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous I found in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober today, and for that I'm very, very thankful. And I'd like to read the preamble, please. So Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. And I'm glad to be here this morning. Are you? All right. Everybody have a good night's sleep? Well, I did too. Everybody rested and ready to go for the day? Good. I'd like to tell you a little story before we get started here this morning. It's about this drunk and his wife were driving down the interstate, and pretty soon the highway patrol pulled him over, and the highway patrol said, well, sir, I'm going to have to give you a ticket for speeding. And he said, now, I was not speeding. I had my cruise control set right on the speed limit, and I was not speeding. And his wife said, now, that's not true. I told you way back there to slow down, or you're going to get a ticket for speeding. He said, you shut up. I'll deal with you, and I get you home. And the highway patrol said, yes, sir, and I'm going to have to give you a ticket for not having your seatbelt on. He said, I had my seatbelt on. I had to take it loose to get to my billfold because I knew you were going to see my driver's license. And his wife said, now, that's not true. Told you way back there to slow down and put your seatbelt on. You're going to get a ticket. He said, you shut up. I'll deal with you and I get you home. The highway patrol said, "Ma'am, does he always talk to you like this?" And she said, "Only when he's drinking." That's Charlie. The women always like that. I don't know why.
Yeah. Good morning, everybody. My name is Charlie Farman, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic. Because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 11,308 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. You guys do look pretty good for 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. Now, they told me we were going to start this thing at 8 o'clock this morning, and I said, hell, I don't even speak to God till 9:30. I don't know how we're going to do a big book study at 8 o'clock. But we'll all do our best. Back on the back table by the popcorn machine, I put some the original dust jackets, similar to the one you saw in the book last night. They've been sized down to fit today's book. And if you want one of those dust jackets, there's a cardboard box laying there. Throw a little donation in there, a dollar or so. The money that you put in there goes into the trust fund for the maintenance and repair of this facility anyhow. So if you'd like to have a dust jacket, they're back there. It's all on an honor basis. Just do what you want to with them. There's also some flyers back there on a couple of cruises that Joe and I are going to be going on in the next year or so, where we do a big book study on the cruise itself. If you're interested in a cruise or something like that, there's some flyers back there. And there's a little brochure on the Founders Foundation Trust Fund, which is a fund that we set up for the maintenance of the Wilson Inn and also Dr. Bob's house in Akron. So if you'd like to get a brochure on that, they're all back there at the back table.
Charlie and I don't really like to go on those cruises. We don't. Somebody has to make a sacrifice for the good of the fellowship. That's Charlie.
Okay, we spent a lot of time last night in preliminaries and getting ready really for the big book study, and talked about the history of the book and talked about the preface and the forewords and so on and so forth. And this morning we're getting ready to get right into what the problem really is. Of course, the problem is going to be talked about in the doctor's opinion. So if you guys are ready this morning, let's go to the doctor's opinion. Let's go to Roman numeral 23, and we'll start looking at what the problem really is. And I don't think we members of AA today realize how lucky we really are to be living in the time and in the century when not only have we found out what alcoholism is, we've also found a solution to that problem. Prior to the 1930s, most alcoholics died from alcoholism. Today, most of them still do. But at least there's a good percentage of us anymore that have had the opportunity to find out what our problem is and also find out what that solution is. A lot of people in AA today seem to think that AA's just been here forever. They seem to think this information's always been around. But we got to realize that alcoholism has been with us for literally thousands of years. Alcoholism itself is not new at all. What is new is that we found out what it is in this particular century. And we do know that this information came from a doctor called Dr. Silkworth. Dr. Silkworth, when he was in medical school, he was interested in we alcoholics at that particular time. But also, back in those days, a doctor could hardly make a living dealing with alcoholics. You know, they didn't want to work with people like us in those days. They really don't like to work with us today. The doctors say they don't like to work with us for two or three reasons. Number one is they say that we never will do what they tell us to do. And certainly that's the truth. And they say we tend to have a tendency to lie to them quite often, and that's the truth. But they say the reason they really don't like to work with us is we don't pay our bills either. And back in Dr. Silkworth's time in the 1920s and early 1930s, very few doctors really liked to work with alcoholics. Silky liked it from the very beginning. But since he couldn't make a living at it, he went off into another field. And we know that during the Depression, he, like everybody else, lost everything they had. in the big stock market crash in the 1929 and into the beginning of the 1930s, necessary for him to find a job. And he went to work at the town's hospital in New York City for the purpose of working with alcoholics. And from the time he went to work at the town's until he met Bill Wilson in 1933, he had worked with many, many, many alcoholics. And he had begun to develop his ideas and his theories about alcoholism simply by experience working with we alcoholics. He would take one of us into that hospital, withdraw us from alcohol, get our body built up in pretty good shape. 30, 60 days later, we would leave that hospital. Next time he would see us, we'd be right back in there, just as bad or even in worse shape than we were before. And he began to talk about the idea that there must be something different in the alcoholic than in normal people. He began to develop these ideas about this actual physical craving of the body. He said, it seems to me as though when most people drink alcohol, they have two or three drinks of alcohol, and that's all they want, and that's all they drink. But he said, it looks to me like maybe one out of ten. Whenever they put alcohol in their system, it actually produces a physical craving, which makes it virtually impossible for them to stop drinking after they've once started. Now, this was brand new information. This was radical information back in the 1920s and the 1930s. He also said most of the people, or many of the people that I deal with, even though they may have trouble with alcohol, after they leave this hospital, they just simply quit drinking, or they some way learn how to moderate their drinking. But he said it seems as though there's a certain percentage of them, though, that always go right back to it over and over and over and over and over. He said this is in the mind rather than in the body. And he began to talk about these two things, the physical craving of the body and the obsession of the mind. Now, we don't know whether Bill Wilson was the first one he told it to or whether Bill was the first one that acted upon it. But we do know he gave this information to Bill in the summer of 1933. We also know that after they decided to write the book, they went to see Dr. Silkworth and said, Doctor, this information that you've given us about alcoholism, which tells us what the problem really is so important to us, we want to put it in this book we're going to write. Would you give us an okay to use that information? And would you write part of it for us? And he said, yes, I'll be glad to do that. He said, I'll be glad to let you use any of the information I have. I'll write part of it for you on one condition. And they said, what's that? And he said, you can't use my name. He said, we doctors have no business stating things as fact unless we can really prove it. And he said, I can't prove this information. So the first thing we'll have to do is call it the doctor's opinion. And he said, don't use my name on it, because if you do, they'll throw me right out of the medical profession. So in all the 16 printings of the first edition, Dr. Silkworth's name doesn't appear there at all. It's just called the doctor's opinion, dash, 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 dash. Now, when they came out with the second printing in 1955, by this time, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, had recognized alcoholism as a full-blown illness. Dr. Silkworth said in the second edition, you can put my name in there now if you want to. So in all the second and third edition, you find Dr. Silkworth's name, but not in the first edition. You know, we always kind of laugh about alcoholism and how long it's been with us. We talk about references to all of our old, old literature where you see references to the alcoholic. Certainly, we find them in a lot of our history. You know, there was a doctor named Dr. Trotter from England who years and years and years ago said that he felt alcoholism was an illness, but he couldn't define what it is, and the only solution he could come up with was absolute abstinence, period. We had a doctor here in the United States, Dr. Benjamin Rush, who was one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence. He wrote a paper on alcoholism. And he said he felt it was an illness also, but he couldn't really determine what it was, And therefore, his only solution was complete abstinence, no drinking of alcohol, period. So throughout the entire human history, we've had this problem with alcoholism. You know, you can go back to the Bible and you find many references in the Bible to alcoholism. There was a fellow named Solomon. He wrote the book of Proverbs for the Bible. And you remember Solomon was a very, very learned individual. He was the one that had all the great wisdom. When people had problems, came to Solomon to get them solved. He might have been the world's first social worker. We don't know whether he was or not, but he could have been. And anyhow, apparently somebody asked Solomon about we alcoholics, because he describes us in the book of Proverbs. He says, who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has redness of eyes? Who has wounds without cause? They that tarry long at the wine. In those days, everybody was a wino. This was before the hard stuff. And he said, you will be like one who sleepeth in the midst of a sea. Remember how you used to go to bed at night and that old bed start moving around on you? Or that sleepeth at the top of a tall mast, how we kind of sway around a little bit when we try to move around and walk and etc. And he said, you will say, they have beaten me and I felt it not. Remember, you used to get up in the morning, you got bruises all over your body, you don't remember how you got them at all. He surely do some of us men. He said, and thine eyes shall behold strange women. Like we said last night, alcoholics really haven't changed much. But then he finished it off by saying, yet they will arise in the morning and seek it yet again. Almost a perfect description of alcoholism as we know it today. So alcoholism is not new. What's new is in this century, we have found out what alcoholism is, and now that we know what it is, we have a solution for it. So let's start looking at the real problem of alcoholism, Joe.
One of the things we did as a fellowship, too, in 1955, when they made the first revisions to the big book and changed the story in the back of the book, for some reason, and we don't know why, they moved the doctor's opinion off of page one. In the first 16 printings, it was on page one. We moved it from page one back into the Roman numeral section. And we all know that alcoholics don't read the Roman numeral sections, do we? So we skipped over that. And then alcoholism became a sin and a lack of willpower and all those sorts of things. And somehow or other, we just ignore the doctor's opinion. But the doctor's opinion is probably one of the most important chapters in this whole book, because the rest of the book is going to tell us how to recover from the condition of body and mind that Silkworth explained. You know, later, last night, that little paragraph we stopped on goes on to say that many do not comprehend that the alcoholic is a very sick person. And certainly when I first come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have no idea that I might be a sick person. I thought I was no good rotten SOB. That's what they told me. I've been married and divorced to two women 7 times, and they treated me pretty rough, you know.
Would you say that again?
7 times. The first one filed for divorce 4 times, and Phyllis filed for divorce 3 times. She only admits to 2, but I filed on her once, and it wasn't even my turn. So they were treating it as if it was a moral issue. And I was a no-good, rotten SOB, and that's what I felt like. When I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, like most everybody I know, I stood in the back of the rooms and I looked down at my feet and I was ashamed of what I had become. Totally ashamed. I thought I was a no good rotten SOB. Come to find out I have an illness called alcoholism. It is an illness. And that kind of raised me above this idea that I'm a no good rotten SOB. You see? And that's why the doctor's opinion is so important to me. I remember one time in 1975, we were sitting in a hotel room and a conference that we were at, and we were talking and were studying about the doctor's opinion, and Charlie said, well, this is not a matter of sin, it's not a matter of lack of willpower or moral character. It's none of those things. And of course, I'd been in AA since 73, and I come in, they said, everybody said they were alcoholics. I said I was an alcoholic. I didn't really know what one was. He said it wasn't any of those things. And I said, well, if it's not that, then what in the hell is it? I want to know. And the doctor's opinion tells me what I really need to know, that I have an illness called alcoholism, and it's not a moral character problem, totally. So in the doctor's opinion, in Roman numeral page 23, It said, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the reader will be interested in the medical estimate of the plan of recovery described in this book. Convincing testimony must surely come from medical men who had experience with the sufferings of our members and have witnessed our return to health. A well-known doctor, chief physician at a nationally prominent hospital specializing in alcoholic and drug addiction, gave Alcoholics Anonymous this letter. To whom it may concern, I have specialized in the treatment of alcoholism for many years. In late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type I had come to regard as hopeless. In the course of his third treatment, he acquired certain ideas concerning a possible means of recovery. As part of his rehabilitation, he commenced to present his conceptions to other alcoholics, and we know this to be Bill Wilson, impressing upon them that they must do likewise with still others. This has become the basis of a rapidly growing fellowship of these men and their families. This man and over 100 others appear to have recovered. I personally know scores of cases who were the type with whom the other methods had failed completely. These facts appear to be of extreme medical importance because of the extraordinary possibilities of rapid growth inherent in this group. They may spark a new epoch in the annals of alcoholism. These men may well have a remedy for thousands of such situations. You may rely absolutely on anything they may say about themselves. Yours very truly, Dr. William D. Silkworth. I'm not sure if we can rely absolutely with what these people might say about themselves, but that's the general idea.
I agree with everything you said except that last statement. I'm not sure that you could rely absolutely on anything we say about ourselves.
He said, this physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Now, there's no must in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, but there's a lot of must in this book, and there's one of the first. We must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind.
Now, this is the first time we can find anywhere in written history a reference to the fact that the body is affected as well as the mind. Everything up until this time talked about the mind only. Weak will, moral character, sin, and etc. But here we see a statement that says the body is quite as abnormal as the mind. And I think he's telling us two things. I think he's telling us first that the body is affected as well as the mind. But I also think he's telling us that our reaction to alcohol is abnormal, both physically and also mentally. The body is quite as abnormal as the mind. And we'll talk about those two abnormal reactions, both bodily and also mentally.
We'll separate those here in a bit, the body from the mind, and talk about them individually. He said, it did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. Now, these things were true to some extent. In fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. But we're sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. The doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinions to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account.
Okay, now, if the purpose of a textbook is to transfer information from the mind of one human being or a group of human beings through the written word to the mind of another human being, thereby increasing the knowledge of the user of the book. And I think that's what textbooks are for. And it stands to reason the transference of that information is going to be based upon an understanding of the words that are used. If the writer of the book uses a certain word and has a certain understanding of that word, the reader of the book reads that word but has a different understanding, then the information that comes through is going to be garbled and incomplete information. And it seems as though there are a few key words in the big book that have given many of us difficulty in the past. And I think one of the first is this word allergy. Most of us, when we get to AA, we already have a preconceived idea of what an allergy is. I know I did. And I knew if you were allergic to something, and you got around it, or you ate it, or you drank it, or whatever, there would be some physical manifestation that you could see that would be the indicator of that allergy. For instance, if you're allergic to strawberries and you eat them, you'll break out in a rash. The rash being the physical manifestation or indicator of that allergy. If you're allergic to milk and you drink it, you'll have a bad case of dysentery. The dysentery being the physical manifestation or indicator of that allergy. If you're allergic to certain plants, such as ragweeds, you get around them, your eyes itch, your nose itch, they water, you begin to sneeze. The itchy, watery eyes, the sneezing, those are the physical manifestations of that allergy. So I knew if you were allergic to something, and you got around it, or you ate it, or you drank it, or whatever, there would be some physical manifestation that you could see. I come to AA, and they said, Charlie, you're allergic to alcohol. You'll never be able to safely drink it again. And I said, how in the hell can I be allergic to alcohol? I'm drinking a quart a day. How can you possibly drink that much of something you're allergic to? And I said, besides that, when I drink alcohol, I don't break out in a rash. I don't have a bad case of dysentery. Once in a while I would, depending on what I'd been drinking, but I normally didn't. And I said, it didn't cause me eyes, nose to itch, water, and sneeze. I don't understand what you're talking about. You need to explain that to me. And they said, well, you don't need to understand. They said, the only thing you need to know is you just can't drink it, period. You're allergic to it. Well, today I think I know why they told me that. I don't think they understood it a bit better than I did. And I went from person to person to person in AA, trying to get somebody to explain this allergy to me. And the answer always was, well, what difference does it make? You're allergic and you can't drink it. Or the answer might be, well, hell, don't worry about it. Just keep coming to meetings and you'll be okay. Nobody could or would explain it to me. Now, if you're the kind of alcoholic that I am, and you get a question like that dangling out here in front of you, sooner or later, if you don't find the answer to it, it's going to drive you out of your mind. Finally, one day, in complete sheer frustration, I went to a source of information that has never failed me since that time. I went to a dictionary, and I looked up the word allergy, and I found several definitions for it, the same as you do with any word, depending on how you're using it, but I found the one I think fits me exactly. It said an allergy is an abnormal reaction to any food, beverage, or substance of any kind. An abnormal reaction. So I began to look back through my drinking history to see where I'm abnormal when it comes to alcohol. And to my amazement, I suddenly realized that I don't know what's normal and what's abnormal. Because the only thing I knew about drinking alcohol is the way I drank it and the way those people drank it who drank with me. And if they didn't drink like I did, they didn't drink with me. So in order for me to find out what's normal, so I can see where I'm abnormal, I have to go to the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker. Those that drink alcohol and have no problems with it. Those that don't get drunk. Those that don't get into difficulties like I get into when I drink. And I ask them to explain to me, tell me, how do you feel after you've had a couple of drinks of alcohol? And usually I'd get an answer similar to this. They'd say, well, I come home from work, tired, tense, wrought up from the day's work, have a drink or two before dinner, go ahead and eat dinner, and then I probably won't drink anymore the rest of that evening. Well, now, I don't feel that way when I drink alcohol. Whenever I take a drink of alcohol, as I put it up to my lips and it crosses my lips immediately begin to tingle. Hits my teeth and they kind of chatter up and down. Strikes my tongue and I can feel my tongue begin to grow and expand and swell. Hits my cheeks and they begin to flutter in and out. I feel it passing through my sinus cavities up into my forehead, and I begin to get a feeling up here in the front of my head which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. I haven't even swallowed the damn stuff yet. I've just got it in my mouth. When I swallow that stuff and it starts down through my esophagus You guys know what happens. The first thing is my chest begins to grow and expand and get bigger and bigger. Hits my stomach and just literally explodes like a bomb. I feel it immediately racing through my arms, and they're getting longer and longer, and hits my hands and fingers, and they begin to tingle and vibrate. At the same time it's racing through my arms, it's racing through my legs. They're getting longer and longer. I'm getting taller and taller, and it hits my feet and toes, and they get a hot, intense, burning, exciting, get up and go somewhere and do something feeling. I don't understand a comfortable, relaxing feeling whenever you have a drink of alcohol. It does something entirely different to me than it does to normal people. Today I know the reason for that. You know, for the normal social drinker, alcohol is a downer, it's not a stimulant. These people tell me that after they have a couple of drinks of alcohol, they begin to get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling up here in their head. Whenever I have a couple of drinks of alcohol, it goes into my body, into my system, goes to my head. I don't get that slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. I get a very exciting, in-control feeling. For we alcoholics, it's a stimulant. For the normal social drinker, it's a downer. For us, it's an upper. They have two drinks and they want to go to bed. I have two drinks and I want to go to town. An entirely different reaction mentally from alcohol. Also, they tell me, they say, Charlie, after we have two or three drinks, we begin to experience a feeling of nausea. And they say, we don't like that feeling of nausea. Therefore, all we want is just one or two drinks. Well, I find that when I put alcohol into my body, instead of my body experiencing a feeling of nausea, it produces an actual physical craving which demands more of the same. They take a couple of drinks and their body says, vomit it up. I take a couple of drinks and my body says, put some more into it. And that's one of the major differences between us and the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker. You know, we just love to watch these normal social drinkers. Quite often we see them on airplanes. You get them in close and you can really watch them and see what they're doing there. I just love to watch them. They'll order one of those little bitty bottles from the flight attendant.
Yeah, $4.
Yeah, pay $4 or $5 for it. It doesn't hold a drink. And they'll get something to mix it with, and they'll pour it in that glass, and they go through what I call the stirring ceremony. They stir, and they stir, and they stir, and they stir. I'm sitting there saying, drink the damn stuff. They're sitting there stirring and stirring and stirring. And you know what to do when they get through stirring? They lay a little stick down, pick up their magazine, and start reading their magazine. I'm saying, drink it, drink it, drink it. And they're not even paying any attention to it. After a while, they'll pick it up and take a little sip out of it and set it back down. After a while, they'll pick it up and take another little sip and set it back down. Quite often, the flight attendant will come around and say, it's about time to land. Are you through with your drink? And they'll say, yeah, I've got all of it I want. And they give half of it back to them. Now, they might call that normal, but I call that sick, sick drinking.
That's alcohol abuse if I've ever heard of it. A few years ago, I was on a plane going to Tulsa to Dallas before I made the switch, and I was doing some research for some of you fellows. There was a young lady about 25 or 6 or 7 years old sitting right across from me, and she'd ordered a drink, and I was watching her very intently. And I began to talk to her. She said, yes, she was going to go to Las Vegas. Was I going to Las Vegas? I said, no, I'm not going. I kind of wished I was, but I wasn't. And she was just talking like, yeah.
Now you got 7 divorces.
Doing a little research. And she was just talking. She was going to have such a great time. The first time she's ever been there, she was so excited. And I was watching the way she was drinking. And she kind of caught me at it. She said, oh, would you want some of this? And I said, no, ma'am, I've got to be home by Christmas. So this story that Charlie just told, let's go back and reread that paragraph, please. He said, the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. As laymen, our opinions to its soundness may, of course, mean little. But as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that his explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. The fact that we have an allergy to alcohol, that once we take a drink, we crave more, unbeknownst to us, and we'll have more. It explains many things for which I could not otherwise account. It would explain to me, for instance, why I would go down by the bar with every intention just drinking two drinks. That's what I was going to do, just two. And the next thing I know, it's midnight or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock or the next day or the next week before I get home. That's the kind of drunk I was. So it explains many things. Once I start to drink, it's virtually impossible to guarantee what I'm going to do. And let's go to Roman numeral page 26.
Now, a good textbook will never tell you anything but what it doesn't give you more information to back it up. He's mentioned the word allergy. Now, let's go over to Roman numeral 26. And we're going to carry this allergy idea just a little bit further. At the abnormal reaction that we alcoholics have to alcohol itself.
He told us over on page 24 about this. Now he's going to tell us again on page 26. He will make sure that we get it. He said, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. You know, I never really liked that word, chronic alcoholic. I've been diagnosed as a chronic, and I hated that word. But come to find out after some study about it, chronic simply means doing the same thing over and over and over again. So therefore, I was a chronic drinker or a chronic alcoholic. And he said, this manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. 9 people drink safely. 1 does not drink safely, and he's considered to have an allergy to alcohol, an allergic reaction. And this allergy cannot happen until after we take a drink. That's very important to understand. Says these allergic types could never safely use alcohol in any form at all. And once having formed the habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-confidence, the reliance upon things human, their problems pile up on them and become astonishingly difficult to solve.
Okay. Statement said, we believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. That the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. Once again, some words we need to be sure that we understand them as the writer understood them. You know, the action of strawberries on one who's allergic to strawberries is manifested by a rash. You can see it. The action of milk on one who's allergic to milk is manifested by dysentery. You can see it. The action of ragweeds on one who's allergic to ragweeds is manifested by itchy, watery eyes and sneezing. You can see it. The action of alcohol on one who's allergic to alcohol is manifested by, he calls it, the phenomenon of craving. You can't see it. You can only feel it. Only alcoholics feel it. It produces an actual physical craving that demands more of the same. He called it the phenomenon of craving. The reason he called it a phenomenon is he didn't understand why. He simply knew that this is what happened to we alcoholics after we put alcohol into our system. So anytime you see the word craving, in the first 164 pages of the Big Book, we're referring to the body, not to the mind. I hear a lot of people say, well, I came to AA and I craved a drink for 3 or 4 or 5 years. No. In the context of the Big Book, that's the wrong use of the word craving. They needed a drink, they wanted a drink, they desired a drink. But the only way an alcoholic can crave alcohol in the context of the Big Book is to first put alcohol in the system. Then the phenomenon of craving develops, and then we can't stop drinking. So anytime we use the word craving, we're talking about the allergy of the body. It has nothing to do with the mind at all. The phenomenon of craving. And it's limited to we alcoholics. Non-alcoholics never feel the manifestation of the allergy to alcohol. They have 1 or 2 or 3 drinks. That's all they want to drink. They get a slightly tipsy, out-of-control feeling. They begin to experience a feeling of nausea. and one, two, or three drinks is all they want to take. With the alcoholics, an entirely different reaction to it. Now, the only difference between normal and abnormal is what do the majority of the people do? If 9 people out of 10 react that way, 1 person out of 10 reacts the way I do, then we are considered to be abnormal in our reaction to alcohol. Therefore, we are considered to be allergic to alcohol. Let's go just a little further. Let's go over on Roman numeral 28. And here he's going to talk about 5 different kinds of alcoholics. But then he's going to drive this point home one more time about the phenomenon of craving, the physical allergy to alcohol.
He said the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult, and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. He said there are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable, so we're all familiar with this type. They're always going on the wagons for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions, but never decisions.
We call that type 1.
There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment.
Type 2.
There is a type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger.
Type 3.
There is a manic depressive type, who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and by whom a whole chapter could be written.
Type 4. Now, I always thought I was the next one. Type 5.
So then there are types entirely normal in every respect, except in effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people.
Any more type 5s in here?
That pretty well describes Charlie, I think.
Now he makes his point. He says all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Now, I think what he said is this, that if all we alcoholics in this room this morning should take a drink, now God forbid that happen, but if we should all take a drink this morning, we would not all react just exactly the same. In just a little bit, one of us would be crying in our beer, oh, boo-hoo-hoo, the world's not treating me right. In just a little bit, one of us would be up on top of this table hooping and hollering and dancing and cutting up and having a hell of a good time. In just a little bit, look back in the back corner, there'll be a couple back there getting in a fight, just sure as anything. Look over in this corner, there'll be a couple over here, one putting the make on the other. We tend to do that too whenever we drink. We would do many different things, but if we're a real alcoholic, there's one thing that every one of us would do. We would start looking for a second drink. The phenomenon of craving has developed. The physical allergy's taken over. Now then, we can't stop, and we got to have a third drink, and a fourth, and a fifth, and a sixth, and a seventh, and on till we're drunk, sick, and in all kinds of trouble. That's the one thing that we have common in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, is in our reaction to alcohol, the physical allergy, the phenomenon of craving that develops after we take a drink of alcohol. And it really doesn't make any difference whether we're born with it or whether we drank ourselves into it. You know, many, many people drank for several years before they started having difficulty with alcohol. I was not one of those. I took my first drink at age 14. The phenomenon of craving developed, and I ended up drunk that night. I drank alcohol for 26 years. I don't ever remember taking one drink of anything that had alcohol in it. One always led to 2 to 3 to 6 to 8 to 10 for me. I think I was born with it, but what difference does it make? The fact remains, that's the way we are today. And I know that's the way we are today, because if we were not that way, we wouldn't be in this room today, would we? If you and I could drink without getting drunk, where would we be? We'd be out there somewhere drinking without getting drunk. But you see, we can't do that because we have this physical allergy to alcohol. And by the way, we feel that's one of the major reasons we need to talk about nothing but alcohol within Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's the only thing that we really have in common is our reaction to alcohol itself. Also, it doesn't make any difference how long it takes us to get drunk. You know, I'm the type of alcoholic, this thing is so pronounced in me, that if I'd take a drink right now, about 15 minutes till 9 here, by noon I've done found me a policeman and I'm in jail somewhere. Some of you might have one or two drinks today, then three or four drinks tomorrow, but it might take you a week to find your policeman and get back in jail. What difference does it make? The first drink we take today is what sets this thing off, and we always end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. That's the thing we've got in common in Alcoholics Anonymous. This was given to us by Dr. Silkworth in the 1930s. He called it the doctor's opinion simply because he couldn't prove it, but he knew it was true based upon his experience in working with many, 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 many of we alcoholics. You know, doctors today, they work with rats. Silky worked with drunks. And he learned by working with drunks. Now, in the 1930s, they knew very little about metabolism. Today, they know much more about metabolism. Today, they know if you take anything in your system, such as a piece of beefsteak, the mind and body has the ability to recognize what it is. Certain organs of the body produce some things called enzymes. The enzymes attack that piece of beefsteak. They begin to break it down and separate it into usable and non-usable items. The usable items that the body needs, the amino acids, the vitamins, etc., the body will retain, and what it can't use, it'll dissipate through the urinary and the intestinal tract. The body does that with anything, providing it's not a deadly poison that kills you before it can be metabolized. It does the same thing with the liquid that it does with the solid. There's been information come out in the last few years regarding the way we metabolize alcohol that has actually pretty well proven the doctor's opinion. It's no longer just an opinion. It's really proven fact. And we're going to look at a little picture here for just a moment. And let us be the first to say that this is not AA information. You know, AA does not get involved as to why we're allergic, because if it did, surely it would create some controversy within our fellowship. But this information has such depth and such interest that I think we would be remiss if we didn't look at it, because it really does prove the doctor's opinion. In that center drawing, you see the nine people who can drink safely. They are at ease with alcohol, the normal, social, temperate, moderate drinker. They take a drink or two, put it in the system. The mind and body recognizes what it is. The enzyme production starts. The enzymes attack the alcohol, break it down first to a material called acetaldehyde. Then after a period of time, it becomes diacetic acid. Then after a period of time, it becomes acetone. Then in its final stages, it becomes a simple carbohydrate made up of water, sugar, and carbon dioxide. The water will be dissipated through the urinary and intestinal tract. The sugar is calories, energy, empty calories. None of the amino acids, none of the vitamins, but a form of energy. The body will burn it as such, store the excess as fat to be used at a later date. The carbon dioxide will be dissipated through the lungs. Drinkers is about an ounce per hour. If they don't drink more than that, they can't get drunk, because their body will burn it up, dissipate it, and get rid of it at that rate. Very seldom do you see a social drinker drinking more than an ounce per hour. Remember, their reaction is a slightly tipsy, out of control, beginnings of a nauseous feeling. And they don't like those feelings, and therefore they're not going to drink it very fast. If you're with one of them and they're drinking more than an ounce per hour, you better get out of the way, because they're probably going to puke on you after a while. It's going to come back out of there after a while. 9 people out of 10 that drink alcohol, that's the way they react to it. Let's look over in the left-hand picture. This is the one person out of 10 who does not drink safely, or he is at dis-ease with alcohol. And that's really all the word disease means, something that separates you from the norm. For one person out of 10, we put it in our system. Same thing happens. The mind and body recognize what it is. The enzyme production starts. It attacks the alcohol, breaks it down to acetaldehyde, then to diacetic acid, and in the final stages it becomes, in the next stage it becomes acetone. Now what they found out about us is the enzymes necessary to break it down from acetone to the simple carbohydrate are not there in the same quantities and or qualities as they are in the body of the non-alcoholic. Therefore, it remains in our body for a much longer period of time as acetone. Today, they have proven that acetone ingested into the human system that remains there for an appreciable period of time creates an actual physical craving for more of the same. In the body of the non-alcoholic, it goes through that stage so rapidly the craving never occurs. In the body of the alcoholic, it remains there long enough. It produces the actual physical craving, and that demands a second drink. Now we take the second drink. We've got most of the acetone from the first drink. Now we add in the acetone from the second drink, and the acetone level goes up. As the acetone level goes up, the craving becomes harder, and that demands a third drink. Now we got most of the first, nearly all the second. Now we put that in from the third. The acetone level goes up further. The craving becomes harder, and that demands a fourth drink. Now at midnight, we're laying out in the parking lot. They've run over us and broken our leg, and they come running up to us and say, "Can we help you?" And we say, "My God, yes, give me another drink." You see, we're craving it harder at midnight after 20 drinks than we were at 6 in the evening after 3 drinks. That explains to me why I never got enough. I drank alcohol 26 years. I don't ever remember drinking all the alcohol I wanted to drink. Oh, hell, I've had more than I needed 1,000 times, but I never got all that I wanted. Simply because you can't feel that craving. The more we drink, the more the body demands, the harder the craving becomes, the more we have to drink. Now, if that never got any worse, you and I could probably learn to handle that situation. But we know not only do we have an illness, but it is a progressive illness that always gets worse, never better. Probably due to 2 reasons. Number one, we know that alcohol is a destroyer of human tissue. We know that over a period of time, the longer we drink, the more tissue we destroy. We also know that the first organs of the body that alcohol attacks in most people will be the liver and the pancreas. Today, they know that the liver and the pancreas are the 2 organs of the body that produce the enzymes necessary to metabolize alcohol. And as we drink and as we begin to destroy those organs, the enzyme production becomes less and less and less. As the enzyme production becomes less and less, the craving becomes harder and harder, the drinking becomes harder and harder also. Probably also due to the aging factor. We know as we get older, the body begins to shut down on the production of everything. Now, I wish that were not true, but believe me, it is. I'm experiencing a lot of that here lately. If I would take a drink today, I wouldn't start where I left off X number of years ago. If I would take a drink today, the craving would be harder, the drinking would be harder, and the resultant trouble would be harder also. So we know not only do we have a physical allergy to alcohol, but we know that we have a progressive physical allergy to alcohol. It always gets worse, never, never better. When I saw this information, when I could fully accept this information, then I could accept the fact that I can no longer safely drink alcohol. Until I saw this, I knew there had to be some way I could drink without getting drunk. And I damn near destroyed me trying to drink without getting drunk. Thank God today we understand the physical allergy. Thank God today we can accept in our lives the fact that we are allergic to it and we'll never be able to safely drink it. And not only do we have an allergy, but we have a progressive allergy that always gets worse, never better.
One more thing about this allergy before we move on is, and Charlie and I have discussed this at great length, Charlie was born with the allergy to alcohol, and when he took his first drink, it just started happening for him right away. That didn't happen for me. I developed mine slowly over a period of time through the use and abuse of alcohol. So the allergy comes on two different ways.
Now, if that was all that was wrong with me, if this was my only abnormal reaction to alcohol, if the physical allergy was my only problem, then we could pass the hat, collect a dollar apiece, get up and go home, and none of us would ever have to drink again. Because the only thing we have to do to control our allergy is just don't drink. As long as I don't put alcohol in my system, the phenomenon of craving could not develop. So in order to control my allergy, the only thing I have to do is just not drink. Isn't that simple? You know, I have a friend who is allergic to, of all things, fish. And every time he eats fish, his throat swells up and he almost chokes to death. Has to go to the hospital every time. Now, the fact that he's allergic to fish, though, is really beside the point, because if he didn't eat fish, that couldn't happen to him. But not only is he allergic to fish, but he seems to have another problem, too. For some reason, there's a light in his head that doesn't come on, or a switch that doesn't close, or something, because from time to time, his mind tells him that it's okay to eat fish. And he'll eat the fish thinking it's going to be okay. Then the allergy takes over, and then he ends up in the hospital. So his real problem centers not in the fact that he's allergic to fish, but it centers in the fact that his mind keeps telling him it's okay to eat fish. Not that it nearly always starts like this. Probably says, well, I haven't had any fish in 90 days. Surely I could have one piece of fish now. Or maybe it's that rock cod I've been eating. If I'd eaten nothing but halibut, everything would be okay. Or it might even say it's them damn people I've been eating fish with. If I'd just change my crowd, for some reason his mind gives him an okay to eat fish. I'm the same identical way when it comes to alcohol. The fact that I'm allergic to alcohol is really beside the point. Because if I don't drink alcohol, my allergy can't hurt me. My real problem centers in the fact that left on my own resources, there seems to be a light bulb up here that doesn't go on, a switch that doesn't work when it comes to alcohol, because left on my own resources, my mind tells me that it's okay to drink alcohol. And based on the fact that this time it's going to be different, I take a drink, and then I trigger the allergy, and then I end up drunk. So our book is going to emphasize to us over and over and over again, the fact that we're physically allergic to alcohol is extremely important to us, but that's not our real problem. Our real problem centers our mind telling us we can drink, rather than in the body that ensures we can't drink. Dr. Silkworth understood us quite well. Now he's going to talk about the mind, the abnormal reaction of the mind.
Dr. Silkworth said it's never been by any treatment which we're familiar with permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. Charlie said if we have an allergy to alcohol, he suggests we don't drink. And that's the end of our drinking problem. But now we're going to talk about the most dangerous part of the illness. And the most dangerous part of the illness is when we're not drinking. And the reason it's the most dangerous part of the illness is when we're not drinking is because we're thinking about drinking. And that's the most dangerous part. So now let's move back to Roman numeral page 26. And we've talked about the body. Now we're going to talk about the obsession of the mind. And we all know that the obsession of the mind is an idea that overpowers all other ideas, although we don't realize that we have that either. Bottom page, Roman numeral page 26. said men and women drink essentially because they lack the effect produced by alcohol.
Now, many alcoholics are highly offended when you tell them that. They say, oh, no, that's not the reason I drink. They say the reason I drink alcohol is because I love the taste of alcohol. Well, I wouldn't argue with them whether they do or not. You know, I love the taste of cold beer. Have loved it all my life, as far back as I can remember. I also love the taste of cold mountain spring water. And I never did sit down and drink a case of cold mountain spring water. You know, alcohol does something for me that cold mountain spring water doesn't do. As a kid growing up, I was always on the outside of the crowd looking in. Always wanted to be a part of. Always knew that whatever I said, whatever I did would be the wrong thing. People would laugh and I would be embarrassed. You girls, I couldn't even get around you. When I got close to one of you, I was absolutely, completely tongue-tied. Couldn't even talk to you. 14 years of age, somebody gave me a drink of moonshine whiskey. And all of those things left me. And I was allowed to function like I'd never been allowed to function before. I was allowed to walk right up to a girl at a dance and ask her to dance with me. I was allowed to ask to take her home from the dance. I was allowed to get in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet and do some things with her I'd been wanting to do for a long, long time. I loved what alcohol did for me. Now, if it made me slightly tipsy, out of control, nauseous feeling, I wouldn't love that, but you see, it gives me that great, exciting, in-control feeling and allows me to do things that I never could do before on my own strength unaided. That's why men and women drink alcohol. We love the effect produced by alcohol.
Many of us have drank for many different effects, and I drank like Charlie did in the beginning. I was a wallflower to school, and my cousin came there with a half a pint of that same kind of whiskey Charlie was talking about. I wanted to dance, couldn't. Took a drink or two of that. Decided to go ask that girl to dance. I went right over and asked her to dance, and we started dancing, and she said, Joe, I didn't know you could dance. I said, hell, I didn't either. But I had a problem. It solved that problem for me. But there are many, many effects by which we drink, and Charlie, we just described one. And sometimes we begin to partake in those effects and begin into a little bit of trouble. And then we start drinking for another effect, to get over the feeling of the anxiety or the guilt, the shame, remorse, the things we did while drinking. And we drink for another effect, to get over some of those things. And as time goes by, we start drinking for many, many effects, the trouble we get into, the jails we got out of, and so on and so forth. And for me, in the end, I drank for the sickest effect of all, and that was total oblivion. And oblivion is a bad effect to be drinking for. Now, there's only one thing wrong with oblivion, isn't there? You wake up, and you got to start all over again. And that's where I found myself in the end. So we drink for many, many effects. He said the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they can after time differentiate the true from the false. And I got to where I didn't know the truth from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And my alcoholic life became normal. The abnormal became normal. He said, I remember one time Phyllis and I woke up one Sunday morning and I had a moment of clarity. And I looked over at Phyllis and I said, Phyllis, do you realize that most people don't drink like we do? You know what she said to me? And I don't talk this way. This is what she said. She said, bullshit. Everybody drinks the way we do. And I got to thinking about it. Well, that's true. Everybody we knew drank just like we did, or we didn't know them. Every bar that we went to, that bar generally drank pretty much the way we did, but we didn't go in that bar. I remember when I got sober and went to my first football game sober. I knew that out there was going to be 50,000 drunks sitting around that stadium. I got out there and I was amazed. I didn't see any drunks. Like I know drunk. Like I was drunk when I was there, you see. So the abnormal had become normal. The abnormal had. And this is what we are when we're not drinking. So they are restless, irritable, and discontented. We put a few more little words in there and say we're full of guilt, shame, and remorse as a result of drinking. Remember when you were brand new, they said if you quit drinking, you're going to feel better? Well, you're going to feel better, all right. You're going to feel resentment better. You're going to feel anger better because you don't have that alcohol to kill the pain. That's why we need to coach us a lot of meetings, get close to our sponsors, and try to start doing these things. He said, unless they can again experience the sense and ease of comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. Impunity means we see other people drinking seemingly without any problem, and we wonder why I can't drink that way. Now, after they have succumbed to desire again, as so many do, and we start drinking, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of esprit, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to drink again. And you all know that I have made that promise to myself and everybody else. I am never going to take another drink as long as I live. I promise you, I promise me, but you see, I didn't know I was an alcoholic. But I was sincere when I made that. So this is repeated over and over and over and over and over. And unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for his recovery. Very little hope for a recovery unless we can experience an entire psychic change. And now they begin to talk about the mind. The psychic is the mind. A change of mind. Some words are in the book they call about a personality change or spiritual awakening. Dr. Silkworth talks about the psychic change. So we must have a psychic change, otherwise we won't overcome alcoholism. And the thing about it is you can't think your way out of it. If you need a psychic change, you're using your head to think. And the more you try to think your way out of it, if you're like me, the deeper into it you get. You see? And that's what these steps are about.
Okay, on this little picture that we've got, on the left-hand side of that sheet, we can see the physical allergy, the fact that we could no longer safely drink alcohol. See if you can scoot me a little more cord out there, will you? On the right-hand side of the sheet, we've put a little picture up here, and we called it an emotional barometer. Right in here, all human beings have emotions. That's good enough. All human beings have emotions.
Give him enough rope there.
I'll hang myself sooner or later. One time I said I'm my own worst enemy, and the guy in the back of the room said, no, not as long as I'm alive, you're not. We all have emotions. We all have feelings of anger and fear and remorse and so on and so forth. And as most of us grow up, these emotions tend to determine how we think and determine how we feel and determine how we do and et cetera. And nearly all kids, as they grow up, they have these same kind of feelings that I had. Many of them feel like they're on the outside of the crowd looking in, and they know if they say the wrong thing, people's going to laugh at them, and they're kind of introverted, and they have a lot of trouble growing up as kids, and most of us do that. Most people, as they grow up, they find some way to overcome those particular kind of feelings and those particular emotions, and they learn how to live with society and get along pretty good. But it seems, though, that people like us, we alcoholics, I know in my particular case, I was always on that outside of the crowd, always looking in, always wanting to be a part of, always knew I could not be. And one night somebody gave me a drink of alcohol. And when they gave me that drink of alcohol, instead of acting as a depressant like it does in normal people, it acted as a stimulant for me, and all of those problems disappeared. And I was really allowed for the first time to function as a normal teenager, to be able to do those things I'd always been afraid to do. Now, when you have problems of any kind and you find an answer for that problem, your mind has a little recording machine up here, and it records the answer for you. And the purpose for that is that the next time you have that problem, it'll play that answer back to you, and you don't have to go look for the answer again. In my particular case, alcohol became the answer to the problem. And I could hardly wait to try it the second time. The second time I tried alcohol, it did the same thing for me. It was absolute, complete magic. So I'd be running around, and I would be restless, and I would be irritable, and I would be discontented. And as an alcoholic, of course, I had a little shame and a little fear and a little guilt and a little remorse associated with the things I'd been doing on my last drunks and et cetera. And even though I was sober, I didn't feel good. And my emotions would reach a certain point, and it would trigger the idea of taking a drink. And I'd take that drink, and all those emotions would disappear, and immediately I would feel better up here in my mind. But of course, the real problem is, not knowing I was alcoholic, after I would take that drink, the drink would come over here and trigger the allergy, and then I'd be unable to stop drinking, and I'd end up drunk and sick and in all kinds of trouble. And I would come off of that drunk down here at the bottom of the chart, and I'd be running around sober, and I'm restless, and I'm irritable, and I'm discontented, and I'm filled with shame, fear, and guilt, and remorse. And as the days go by, the emotions begin to build up again. Now, it's not the big things in life that get we alcoholics. It's the little things. Having to get up every morning and go to work. Burnt bacon. Bitchy husbands. Screaming kids. Broken shoelaces. Flat tires. Empty gas tanks. Bitchy bosses. All the things that everybody has to deal with as we go through life, those things begin to build up and build up and build up and build up. And it reaches a certain point, triggers the idea of taking a drink in order to feel better. We take the drink, and sure enough, we feel better that first drink or two. Like Dr. Silkworth says, that great sense of ease and comfort that comes from a couple of drinks, but then that triggers the allergy. We can't stop drinking. We go through the well-known stages of a spree, and we come off of that drunk down at the bottom again, restless and irritable and discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. Now, the real problem is that this thing is progressive. And as we go through the time, triggering the idea to take a drink, taking a drink, triggering the allergy, damage to the body, each time it gets a little worse and a little worse and a little worse and a little worse. The drunks get a little harder and get a little longer. We get into more and more trouble. The emotional stage down here on the bottom gets a little worse also. Now, somewhere down the line, if you're like I am, I begin to realize one day that, hey, Charlie, you're having a problem with alcohol. You really need to do something about your drinking. Now, the thought never crossed my mind that I ought to stop drinking. What I said to myself is that you better learn how to control your drinking while drinking. Any of you all ever try to control your drinking while drinking? Tonight we're just going to have a half a pint. That's all we're going to buy, period. You can't get drunk on that. Or this time we're going to drink nothing but cold beer. Or this time we're going to have a glass of wine, and that's going to be it. And I assumed that I could control my drinking while drinking. Well, today I realize why I couldn't control my drinking while drinking was because of the physical allergy. Of course, I didn't know that. So I spent several years trying to control my drinking while drinking, not knowing I couldn't do that, and things got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. Finally, I reached the stage in my drinking that all of us eventually reach. I said, Charlie, I don't believe you can drink. Now, what you better do is just quit drinking. Any of y'all ever just quit drinking? When an alcoholic finally reaches that stage and just quits drinking, he trots out the most useful tool he has. He puts it right in there between the emotional barometer and the desire to drink, and it's called willpower. And I said, sick 'em, Will. We're through with that drinking. We're never going to take another drink as long as we live. Now, as the days went by, I'm sober, but I'm restless, and I'm irritable, and I'm discontented. And I'm filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse associated with those things I've done while drinking. As the days go by, the emotions begin to build up and build up and build up, and they reach a certain point, and it triggers the idea to take a drink, and willpower said, no, we're through with that drinking. We've sworn off. We're never going to drink again as long as we live, and we probably don't drink that day. But the next day we get up, and we're still restless and irritable and discontented. We're a little bit worse today in our emotional barometer. Triggers the idea to take a drink, and willpower says no. And willpower stops us from drinking for a period of time. One time I did this for about 3 months. Day after day after day after day after day, willpower saying, no, 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 we're not going to drink. But one day, the desire to drink burned through willpower, said, let's take a drink. And I took a drink, it triggered the allergy, and I couldn't stop drinking. Because you see what happens to you and I. Just before we take the first drink, we don't see anything wrong with taking the first drink. We've convinced ourselves that this time it's going to be different. This time we're just going to have two drinks. This time we're not going to get drunk. And the only time willpower works is when the mind sees something wrong with what it wants to do. And just before we take our first drink, our mind has pushed out what alcohol does to us. It has pushed out the car wrecks and the jailhouses and the divorce courts, and it's concentrating on one thing and one thing only, the sense of ease and comfort that's going to come at once by taking a couple of drinks, and thinking about what it'll do for us pushes out the idea of what it does to us, and we actually believe that it's okay to drink. We take the drink, we trigger the allergy, we go through the well-known stages of a spree again, and Dr. Silkworth says, we repeat this cycle over and over and over and over again. Unless we can experience an entire psychic change. Psychic deals with the way we think, our ideas, and our attitude toward life. Just think, if I could find a way to live where I could be sober down here on the bottom, and not be restless, irritable, and discontented. If I could find a way to live where I could be sober down on the bottom and not be filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse, then maybe I could find a way to live where I could be sober and peaceful and happy and free. And then I don't need the sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a couple of drinks. And that's what recovery is about. That's what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous does for me. It changes my entire attitude toward life, people, places, and things where my emotions do not build up to the point that triggers the idea of taking a drink. Don't have to be perfect. We'll never get perfect. But I don't have to have the idea of taking a drink in order to feel better because we already feel good enough. That's what's called recovery. And that's what comes about from the last 10 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Dr. Jung said it was psychic change, later on they talk about personality change, spiritual awakening, spiritual experiences. Dr. Jung told Roland that ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were the guiding force of the lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side. So we're talking about the things that goes on the mind. And he says, and on the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. And that's exactly what the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is all about, to help us to overcome this powerless condition of the body and the mind.
Okay, now that we see what the problem is, that it's not willpower, that it's not moral character, it's not sin, an actual illness, a twofold illness, an illness of the body, the physical allergy, and an obsession of the mind, the idea that keeps us going back and trying it over and over again. Now that we see what the problem is, then maybe we can find a solution to that problem. Let's take a 15-minute break. We're going to jump right into Bill's story and move right on through the book.